I'm very happy now to welcome Sid Redner. He's a physicist, former physics professor at Boston University, and currently he's a professor at the Santa Fe Institute. He will be speaking tomorrow, Wednesday, the 15th of October at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater. His talk is titled, I Get All the News I Need from the Sports Section. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So you are studying baseball and basketball from the point of view of a physicist. What's going on?
Well, I'm trying to look at all of the data and try and distill some basic universal patterns in things like the scoring statistics or win-loss records of the various teams.
And so let's talk for a moment about baseball. I mean, baseball is probably a different sport than it was 1500 years ago, a very highly developed, very competitive sport. What do you learn when you, first of all, what are you studying? I mean, are you a sports fan?
Not really. I'm a fan of sports statistics. I love reading the sports pages. I don't care at all about the individuals, but I like reading the statistics.
Isn't that funny? So you don't go to the games and have favorite players and that kind of stuff?
My office at BU was a quarter mile from Fenway Park. I never was at Fenway Park.
Very interesting. So what are you looking at? You're looking at statistics. What do you get from them?
Well, the two specific things that I was looking at in baseball were the win-loss records of teams and winning and losing streaks of games. So the thing is that if you look at the win-loss records, obviously the top team has a good record, the lowest team has a lousy record. But what we were trying to look at was how does the record averaged over many years of a team depend on its relative ranking? And we found a very simple statistical pattern that describes that.
So what, like, put that in language that I might understand.
Well, if I look at the standings at the end of the season,
You look at 10 seasons.
well, let's just look at one season to begin with. So the
Okay.
top team might have a winning record of 0.7. The bottom team might have a winning record of 0.4. And if you look at the winning record as a function of the rank of the team, so if I call the top ranked team rank 1 and the bottom ranked team rank 0, and everything in between is between 0 and 1 in its rank, so clearly the number of wins or the fraction of wins will be an increasing function of the rank. It just stands to reason. But if you look at averaged over many seasons, one sees a very simple curve for this win fraction as a function of rank that we can actually calculate analytically and compare with the baseball data and compare successfully with the baseball data.
And so, how does that correlate to all the stuff that goes on, like trading players and trying to get the best player on your team?
Well, in some sense, I would consider that kind of small-scale perturbations on the overall picture. So in the modeling that we did, we assumed that each team had a fixed strength that was determined by the end of season record and used that as a proxy for determining what was the result of any given game. So things like injuries, trading players, things like that, those do play some role, but they're a smaller effect compared to the overall strength of the team over the entire season.
So if I'm a player on one of these baseball teams and I'm doing my best, at the end of the season, everything that I did conforms to a statistical pattern that is way beyond me as a player.
That's correct. I mean, the thing is that Major League Baseball is a highly competitive environment. You have to go through all kinds of filters to make it to Major League Baseball. But once you're there, everybody else is very well trained. Everybody else is almost as good as you are or as good as you are. Everybody is an excellent ball player. And in that highly competitive environment, you then try and determine, like, well, what will be the result of 15 or 30 teams trying to compete for the World Series? What will be the result over the length of a season? And it turns out that making the simplest possible assumptions about the relative strength of teams, namely that there is some range of team strengths, and that's it. There's only a range of team strengths. In terms of just that one variable, we can then describe essentially all of the statistics of win-loss records of all of baseball teams.
You have described baseball as a kind of evolutionary arms race. What does that mean?
It's just that in any competitive environment, if you have an advantage, then other people are competing for the same resource. They're going to see you have an advantage and try and replicate what you're doing. And if you're losing out in this evolutionary arms race, you'll be cut from the team or something of the same ilk. So the point is that outliers typically are not sustainable, and people generally move to the mean. And so the way that we saw this in baseball win-loss records is that if you look at the win-loss records from 70 or 80 years ago, the best team typically had a winning record of 67%, and the worst team had a winning record of about 33%. Over the past 30 or 40 years, the best team has a winning record of the order of 0.6, and the worst team has a winning record of about 0.4. So what it means...
So they've moved closer together.
They've moved closer together, and it's been happening systematically over the course of a century of baseball.
Now, what would have been considered an outlier in baseball at some point in history?
Well, hitting 400 is the classic example.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the last time it was done by was Ted Williams.
He had a 400 average, which is amazing.
No, in one season.
In one season.
That's right.
And now that's not really possible because the pitchers are just...
Well, again, what I would say is that he was an exceptional ball player. And in Major League Baseball in the 40s and 50s and 60s when he played, there was a wider disparity in the relative abilities of the different players. Now there's more coaching, more training, all year round training, and so to have an exceptional person who can just stand out above the field is much less likely to occur. So since Ted Williams' time, there's been no one who's hit 400.
And yet probably the players are more consistently strong across the board.
Absolutely. But the pitchers are also more consistently
exactly.
strong. And then there's relief pitchers, and then there's coaches, and then there's training off season. And so the whole, you know, the net effect of all these additional features in baseball makes it much harder to stand out.
It's sort of like, I mean, I've been watching the Olympics since I was probably 11 years old, and every time there are new Olympic records.
That's correct.
And human beings are not really evolving. You know, we're not getting faster and stronger because we're on some kind of human time, but...
Well, actually, I think we are. I think that certainly physically, the nature of, like, the best Olympic sprinters now is very different than they were in 1896.
But, I mean, Homo sapiens hasn't evolved since then.
No.
Yeah. But the training methods have. Well, let's talk for a moment about basketball. Basketball, also a great place for statistics because there's so much scoring.
That's correct. That's what makes it fun for a point of view of analysis. There's so much scoring that one has very beautiful, clean data with which one can come up with hypotheses that can be tested unambiguously.
And so what are you looking at when you take basketball scores?
Well, the very first thing we wanted to ask are the scoring events in basketball random events? And the answer seems to be yes.
Now, I'm a basketball player. I shoot a basket. I make it. I've trained all my life to do it. What's random about that?
Nothing is random about that, but it's the integral effect of all the different players trying to score and the teams fighting each other for the basketball. So, for example, if I study what is the time interval between scoring events. So there is now 24-second clock in basketball, so you might say, well, the typical time between scoring events is around 30 seconds, which is the correct answer. But if I look at the distribution of times between scoring events, if it was not random, if it was all determined by the 24-second clock, then you would see that every 30 seconds, roughly speaking, there would be a score. But you don't see anything like that. In fact, you see that there are scoring droughts that last as long as 6 or 7 minutes in basketball games.
Where everybody's fighting for the ball and nobody scores a basket.
That's right. And other times the baskets happen really quick with very small time intervals. So the fact that there is this broad distribution of times between scoring events, it turns out that it's described exactly by a random process.
Now, this random process is called a random walk, which is a technical term. I mean, it sounds like I'm walking downtown and don't know where I'm going. But
More or less, that's correct.
But it has a mathematical meaning.
That's correct.
What is it?
So the random walk is a very simple model that was first used to describe the motion of small particles in a fluid. When the microscope was first invented in 1785, it was observed that pollen particles in a fluid would move around in a visually random-looking manner. And that's the result of all the collisions between the pollen particles and the liquid molecules. And from that, people extracted simple models to try and describe that reality. And the simplest one is to ignore all the effects of these collisions between the pollen and the fluid particles and replace it by an effective motion in which a particle just picks some direction, moves along it a trajectory for a certain amount of time, and then switches its direction randomly and does this process over and over again. So if you look at a trajectory of a single pollen particle, it will look something like a random trajectory that's changing its direction randomly, changing the length of the trajectories randomly. This is what's known as a random walk process.
Is there anything like bigger than a pollen particle, like, you know, a dog walking or a rabbit or something like that?
Well, no. Typically, this type of random walk motion, when it's describing the motion of particles or animals or something like that, it has to happen at the microscopic world where collisions play a huge role. At mm-hmm. the macroscopic world, it doesn't play a role because, like, the wind blowing on a dog isn't going to push it around very much. But on the other hand, there are many other processes in nature where random walks play a huge role. And a typical one is the random walk on Wall Street. Fluctuations in stock prices are described by a more exotic random walk process, but you can think in terms of random walk as a way of describing stock market fluctuations.
One of the ways that you have described random walk is a drunkard walking out of a bar, doesn't know whether to go right or left,
right,
and just sort of moves around.
Exactly so. That is the simplest version of the random walk model. It's if I just think of going only left or right of a random walker living on a one-dimensional line where there is a bar at every block of a city that's living in one dimension, it turns out that this model can be analyzed in complete detail. One can understand everything about it, and one understands that the random walk model has some very beautiful properties that underlie so many other random processes in nature.
Which is quite amazing that it applies in any way to basketball.
Yeah, isn't it?
How do you understand that?
Well, the way I understand it is that you have two teams that are trying to score, but you have an opponent who's almost the same strength as you, and so you're playing this tug of war of trying to get the ball in the other guy's basket. And the net effect of this tug of war is that whether Team A scores or Team B scores is a random event that takes a random amount of time to actually occur.
It's not a random event to the people playing.
No, absolutely not.
But to the statistician, it is.
Well, it's also, I would say that you as a basketball player, you're trying your hardest to try and score the basket. But you have an opponent who's trying your hardest to prevent you from scoring. And so what makes a basket actually happen is a confluence of what can seem to be in the aggregate a random event.
So what does this mean for physicists, for athletes, for gamblers?
Well, for gamblers, I think that they're always looking for an edge to try and distill some kind of systematic pattern from seemingly random data so they'll know how to bet. So maybe there's something I could say, because actually one thing that's not going to be in my talk tomorrow night, but which I've been looking at a little bit, is like, what is the probability that a lead of a given size is safe? And again, using random walk ideas, we can make some predictions about that.
Interesting. So when a lead, let's say a team is ahead, a basketball team is ahead by 15 points.
With, say, 6 minutes to go, is that lead safe or not?
Right.
So again, in the framework of a random walk model, we can precisely answer that question, is that lead safe? And we're in the process now of trying to compare that with basketball data and see, like, how well does the basketball data conform to a random walk model for that lead probability being safe.
Now, you're talking about professional sports. You're talking about the National Basketball Association. You're talking about professional baseball. What if you were talking about Santa Fe High versus Pecos? You've got teams that might be kind of mismatched, or in any given year, there's a huge variety of abilities on the team.
Correct. Well, so again, the thing about NBA basketball is that the best team might lose to the worst team in the league on any given night. Whereas like in, say, high school basketball or football, you could imagine that the best team will have no chance of being upset by the very worst team. So there's a stronger bias in these lower level leagues. But the point is that as you go up in league, you know, you go from high school basketball to NCAA basketball, there's so many layers of selection, always taking the best players. So by the time you get to the elite leagues, the disparity in the abilities is really quite small.
So basically, when you get to the elite leagues, you've got a bunch of particles with all the same properties,
roughly
only they're
speaking.
People.
Yeah, roughly yeah. speaking.
So we've said that there are a few things that maybe gamblers would be interested. What about sports fans?
Well, I think for sports fans, it seems to me that what sports fans are interested in is in the microscopic details of the game. They might care about, will Peyton Manning pass for 5 touchdowns in this game? Will LeBron James score 50 points in this game? You know, they're so taken by emotional considerations. The physicist in me doesn't care anything about that. I'm looking at a game as a purely statistical event and studying the data from the pure statistics, and I don't care who scored the basket, when the final basket was scored. I'm just caring about the total number of baskets, the distribution of the times between baskets. So I'm looking at it from a very, you know, maybe heartless perspective, but, you know, one that's like data-driven to try and distill some facts from the data.
And so when you're looking at it as a physicist, what does that tell you? What is it analogous to in other parts of your work as a physicist?
Well, I guess the main thing here is the search for underlying simplicity. If I look at basketball, and if I were to know nothing about basketball, I would see these very athletic men running up and down the court doing these amazing feats of athletic ability. How do I understand that? But if I'm looking at that level, it's very difficult to understand. But if you start looking at just the outcome of the game, the statistics of scoring, one sees some very simple statistical patterns. And in a lot of my research, that's what I'm looking for, is taking a complex system that has a lot of data, trying to distill some simple universal patterns with which I can make a hypothesis and understand.
What are some of the other systems that you've looked at?
Well, I've looked a lot at the structure of complex networks. I've looked a lot at the structure of the time and evolution of chemical reactions. I've looked a lot at social dynamics, how people's opinions change as a function of time. I've looked at the evolution of ferromagnetic spin systems. So these seem to be all very disparate systems, but they're all characterized by having many interacting units, competitive or cooperative interactions, and oftentimes universal statistical patterns emerge from the data.
I'm intrigued by the idea of studying how people change their opinions over time. That's something that you can look at that ends up yielding simple statistical patterns.
That's correct.
What are they based on?
Well, I mean, it turns out that in my field of physics, people have looked at a wide variety of models to describe cooperative behavior of many particle systems. And there was actually a very beautiful model that was invented by the mathematicians called the Vogler model. And it turns out to be, first of all, exactly soluble, and just a very compelling model to understand how consensus might arise in a population of people. So the Vogler model is, you imagine you have a population of people in a finite room. Every person has zero self-confidence. Every person has only two states. They're either, say, Democrat or Republican. And the evolution of the population is the following. You pick a person at random. They have no self-confidence. And so I look at you, and I ask, well, who did you vote for in the last election? And you say, well, I voted for X. And I say, X, that was a great idea. I will also vote for X because I have no self-confidence. If you then run this dynamics over and over again, pick a person at random, they pick a neighbor, they adopt the state of the neighbor, this system will ultimately reach consensus in a finite time. It can be calculated. One can understand the spread of single opinion correlations throughout the system. And this is the Vogler model, and it turns out to be a very beautiful model for describing many particle systems and the evolution to consensus.
And so many particle systems might be people with ideas about who to vote for, or they might be little inanimate things running around in.
Exactly so. The same kind of mathematics that describes the evolution of people talking to each other and trying to figure out what to do is very similar to what happens if I'm studying a ferromagnet, where I have inside a piece of iron, cobalt, or nickel, I have a spin, which is maybe pointing in the North Pole, and maybe one of its neighbors pointing in the South Pole and can influence it to change its direction.
So when you look at, for example, how people's opinions have changed about something like gay marriage, which has changed very quickly in the last few years.
Absolutely. That's an amazing social phenomenon that I don't think is at all understood. First of all, the voter model is a complete idealization of any kind of reality of social evolution. But it, just as like in many fields of physics, one starts with the simplest models and then tries to develop from the simple models particularities that might be relevant to a particular situation. So the issue of like how gay marriage has become something that was verboten to now, it's like everybody says we have to support it. I don't know. I don't have a good model for it at the moment, but it's certainly something on my mind as a compelling social phenomenon. Like, how does rapid consensus emerge for a particular issue where like we can't have consensus about like how much we're going to spend on, you know, some small amount in the education department, and so we have filibusters and government shutdowns, but gay marriage, it seems like in the space of a few years, has gone from one side to the other.
It does make you wonder how strongly held and meaningful your opinions are if they're behaving like magnets.
Well, again, in the field of social dynamics, there are much more sophisticated models of how opinions evolve. And so this model of this voter model is obviously way too simplistic, but people have worried about issues where you have kind of some internal clock, but nevertheless how you express your opinions might actually be in conflict with your internal being.
Right. Well, much more to talk about, but it's just about time to go. Sid Redner is a physicist. He's a professor at the Santa Fe Institute, and he will be giving a talk tomorrow called I Get All the News I Need from the Sports Section. That's Wednesday, October 15th, 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater. And as always, it's free to the public. For more information, santafe.edu. Sid Redner, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.